The Gospels? 1. Introduction. Many readers of the Gospels are embarrassed and even abashed when they stop to think about the meaning of certain descriptions. The same is true when they make comparisons between different versions of the same event found in several Gospels. This observation is made by Father Agay in his book Initiation to the Gospels. With the wide experience he has gained in his many years of answering perturbed readers' letters in a Catholic weekly, he has been able to assess just how greatly they have been worried by what they have read. His questioners come from widely varying social and cultural backgrounds. He notes that their requests for explanations concern texts that are considered abstruse, incomprehensible, if not contradictory, absurd or scandalous. There can be no doubt that a complete reading of the Gospels is likely to disturb Christians profoundly. This observation is very recent. Father Agay's book was published in 1973. Not so very long ago, the majority of Christians knew only selected sections of the Gospels that were read during services or commented upon during sermons. With the exception of the Protestants, it was not customary for Christians to read the Gospels in their entirety. Books of religious instruction only contained extracts, the in extensa text hardly circulated at all. At a Roman Catholic school I had copies of the works of Virgil and Plato, but I did not have the New Testament. The Greek text of this would nevertheless have been very instructive. It was only much later on that I realized why they had not set us translations of the holy writings of Christianity. The latter could have led us to ask our teachers questions they would have found it difficult to answer. These discoveries, made if one has a critical outlook during a reading in extens of the Gospels, have led the Church to come to the aid of readers by helping them overcome their perplexity. Many Christians need to learn how to read the Gospels, notes Father Agay. Whether or not one agrees with the explanations he gives, it is greatly to the author's credit that he actually tackles these delicate problems. Unfortunately, it is not always like this in many writings on the Christian revelation. In editions of the Bible produced for widespread publication, introductory notes more often than not set out a collection of ideas that would tend to persuade the reader that the Gospels hardly raise any problems concerning the personalities of the authors of the various books, the authenticity of the texts and the truth of the descriptions. In spite of the fact that there are so many unknowns concerning authors of whose identity we are not at all sure, we find a wealth of precise information in this kind of introductory note. Often they present as a certainty what is pure hypothesis, or they state that such and such an evangelist was an eyewitness of the events, while specialist works claim the opposite. The time that elapsed between the end of Jesus' ministry and the appearance of the texts is drastically reduced. They would have one believe that these were written by one man taken from an oral tradition, when in fact specialists have pointed out adaptations to the texts. Of course, certain difficulties of interpretation are mentioned here and there, but they ride roughshod over glaring contradictions that must strike anyone who thinks about them. In the little glossaries one finds among the appendices complementing a reassuring preface, one observes how improbabilities, contradictions or blatant errors have been hidden or stifled under clever arguments of an apologetic nature. This disturbing state of affairs shows up the misleading nature of such commentaries. The ideas to be developed in the coming pages will without doubt leave any readers still unaware of these problems quite amazed. Before going into detail, however, I will provide an immediate illustration of my ideas with an example that seems to me quite conclusive. Neither Matthew nor John speaks of Jesus's ascension. Luke in his Gospel places it on the day of the resurrection and 40 days later in the Acts of the Apostles, of which he is said to be the author. Mark mentions it, without giving a date, in a conclusion considered unauthentic today. The ascension therefore has no solid scriptural basis. Commentators nevertheless approach this important question with incredible lightness. Tricott, in his Little Dictionary of the New Testament in the Crampon Bible, 1960 edition, a work produced for mass publication, does not devote an entry to the ascension. The synopsis of the four Gospels, Synopse des Quatre Evangiles, by Fathers Benoit and Boismard, teachers at the Biblical School of Jerusalem, 1972 edition, informs us in Volume 2, pages 451 and 452, that the contradiction between Luke's Gospel and the Acts of the Apostles may be explained by a literary artifice. This is, to say the least, difficult to follow. In all probability, Father Regay in his Initiation to the Gospel, 1973, page 187, has not been convinced by the above argument. The explanation he gives us is curious, to say the least. Here, as in many similar cases, the problem only appears insuperable if one takes biblical statements literally, and forgets their religious significance. It is not a matter of breaking down the factual reality into a symbolism which is inconsistent, but rather of looking for the theological intentions of those revealing these mysteries to us by providing us with facts we can apprehend with our senses and signs appropriate to our incarnate spirit. How is it possible to be satisfied by an exegesis of this kind? Only a person who accepted everything unconditionally would find such apologetic set phrases acceptable. Another interesting aspect of Father Regay's commentary is his admission that there are many similar cases, similar, that is, to the ascension in the Gospels. The problem therefore has to be approached as a whole, objectively and in depth. It would seem reasonable to look for an explanation by studying the conditions attendant upon the writing of the Gospels, or the religious atmosphere prevailing at the time. When adaptations of the original writings taken from oral traditions are pointed out, and we see the way texts handed down to us have been corrupted, the presence of obscure, incomprehensible, contradictory, improbable, and even absurd passages comes as much less of a surprise. The same may be said of texts which are incompatible with today's proven reality, thanks to scientific progress. Observations such as these denote the element of human participation in the writing and modification of the texts. Admittedly, in the last few decades, objective research on the scriptures has gained attention. In a recent book, Faith in the Resurrection, Resurrection of Faith, Father Canningesser, a professor at the Catholic Institute of Paris, outlines this profound change in the following terms: the faithful are hardly aware that a revolution has taken place in methods of biblical exegesis since the time of Pius XII. The revolution that the author mentions is therefore very recent. It is beginning to be extended to the teaching of the faithful, in the case of certain specialists at least, who are animated by this spirit of revival. The overthrow of the most assured prospects of the pastoral tradition, the author writes, has more or less begun with this revolution in methods of exegesis. Father Canningesser warns that one should not take literally facts reported about Jesus by the Gospels, because they are writings suited to an occasion or to combat, whose authors are writing down the traditions of their own community about Jesus. Concerning the resurrection of Jesus, which is the subject of his book, he stresses that none of the authors of the Gospels can claim to have been an eyewitness. He intimates that, as far as the rest of Jesus's public life is concerned, the same must be true because, according to the Gospels, none of the apostles, apart from Judas Iscariot, left Jesus from the moment he first followed him until his last earthly manifestations. We have come a long way from the traditional position, which was once again solemnly confirmed by the Second Vatican Council only 10 years ago. This once again is resumed by modern works of popularization destined to be read by the faithful. Little by little the truth is coming to light, however. It is not easy to grasp, because the weight of such a bitterly defended tradition is very heavy indeed. To free oneself from it, one has to strike at the roots of the problem, that is, examine first the circumstances that marked the birth of Christianity. 2. Historical reminder: Judeo-Christianity and Saint Paul. The majority of Christians believe that the Gospels were written by direct witnesses of the life of Jesus and therefore constitute unquestionable evidence concerning the events highlighting his life and preachings. One wonders, in the presence of such guarantees of authenticity, how it is possible to discuss the teachings derived from them and how one can cast doubt upon the validity of the Church as an institution applying the general instructions Jesus himself gave. Today's popular editions of the Gospels contain commentaries aimed at propagating these ideas among the general public. The value the authors of the Gospels have as eyewitnesses is always presented to the faithful as axiomatic. In the middle of the 2nd century, Saint Justin did, after all, call the Gospels the memoirs of the apostles. There are moreover so many details proclaimed concerning the authors that it is a wonder that one could ever doubt their accuracy. Matthew was a well-known character, a customs officer employed at the tollgate or customs house at Capernaum. It is even said that he spoke Aramaic and Greek. Mark is also easily identifiable as Peter's colleague. There is no doubt that he too was an eyewitness. Luke is the dear physician of whom Paul talks. Information on him is very precise. John is the apostle who was always near to Jesus, son of Zebedee, fisherman on the Sea of Galilee. Modern studies on the beginnings of Christianity show that this way of presenting things hardly corresponds to reality. We shall see who the authors of the Gospels really were. As far as the decades following Jesus's mission are concerned, it must be understood that events did not at all happen in the way they have been said to have taken place, and that Peter's arrival in Rome in no way laid the foundations for the church. On the contrary, from the time Jesus left earth to the second half of the 2nd century, there was a struggle between two factions. One was what one might call Pauline Christianity, and the other Judeo-Christianity. It was only very slowly that the first supplanted the second, and Pauline Christianity triumphed over Judeo-Christianity. A large number of very recent works are based on contemporary discoveries about Christianity. Among them we find Cardinal Danielou's name. In December 1967 he published an article in the review Studies, Etudes, entitled A New Representation of the Origins of Christianity, Judeo-Christianity. Here he reviews past works, retraces its history and enables us to place the appearance of the Gospels in quite a different context from the one that emerges on reading accounts intended for mass publication. What follows is a condensed version of the essential points made in his article, including many quotations from it. After Jesus's departure, the little group of apostles formed a Jewish sect that remained faithful to the form of worship practiced in the temple. However, when the observances of converts from paganism were added to them, a special system was offered to them. As it were, the Council of Jerusalem in 49 AD exempted them from circumcision and Jewish observances. Many Judeo-Christians rejected this concession. This group was quite separate from Paul's. What is more, Paul and the Judeo-Christians were in conflict over the question of pagans who had turned to Christianity, the incident of Antioch, 49 AD. For Paul, the circumcision, Sabbath, and form of worship practiced in the temple were henceforth old-fashioned, even for the Jews. Christianity was to free itself from its political cum religious adherence to Judaism, and open itself to the Gentiles. For those Judeo-Christians who remained loyal Jews, Paul was a traitor. Judeo-Christian documents call him an enemy, accuse him of tactical double-dealing. Until 70 AD, Judeo-Christianity represents the majority of the church and Paul remains an isolated case. The head of the community at that time was James, a relation of Jesus. With him were Peter, at the beginning, and John. James may be considered to represent the Judeo-Christian camp, which deliberately clung to Judaism as opposed to Pauline Christianity. Jesus's family has a very important place in the Judeo-Christian Church of Jerusalem. James's successor was Simeon, son of Cleopas, a cousin of the Lord. Cardinal Danielou here quotes Judeo-Christian writings which express the views on Jesus of this community which initially formed around the apostles. The Gospel of the Hebrews, coming from a Judeo-Christian community in Egypt, the writings of Clement, homilies and recognitions, hypotypicize, the second apocalypse of James, the Gospel of Thomas. It is to the Judeo-Christians that one must ascribe the oldest writings of Christian literature. Cardinal Danielou mentions them in detail. It was not just in Jerusalem and Palestine that Judeo-Christianity predominated during the first 100 years of the Church. The Judeo-Christian mission seems everywhere to have developed before the Pauline mission. This is certainly the explanation of the fact that the letters of Paul allude to a conflict. They were the same adversaries he was to meet everywhere, in Galatia, Corinth, Colossae, Rome, and Antioch. The Syro-Palestinian coast from Gaza to Antioch was Judeo-Christian as witnessed by the Acts of the Apostles and Clementine writings. In Asia Minor, the existence of Judeo-Christians is indicated in Paul's letters to the Galatians and Colossians. Poppius's writings give us information about Judeo-Christianity in Phrygia. In Greece, Paul's first letter to the Corinthians mentions Judeo-Christians, especially at Apollos. According to Clement's letter and the Shepherd of Hermas, Rome was an important center. For Suetonius and Tacitus, the Christians represented a Jewish sect. Cardinal Danielou thinks that the first evangelization in Africa was Judeo-Christian. The Gospel of the Hebrews and the writings of Clement of Alexandria link up with this. It is essential to know these facts to understand the struggle between communities that formed the background against which the Gospels were written. The texts that we have today, after many adaptations from the sources, began to appear around 70 AD, the time when the two rival communities were engaged in a fierce struggle, with the Judeo-Christians still retaining the upper hand. With the Jewish War and the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the situation was to be reversed. This is how Cardinal Danielou explains the decline. After the Jews had been discredited in the empire, the Christians tended to detach themselves from them. The Hellenistic peoples of Christian persuasion then gained the upper hand. Paul won a posthumous victory. Christianity separated itself politically and sociologically from Judaism, it became the third people. All the same, until the Jewish revolt in 140 AD, Judeo-Christianity continued to predominate culturally. From 70 AD to a period sometime before 110 AD, the Gospels of Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John were produced. They do not constitute the first written Christian documents, the letters of Paul date from well before them. According to O. Cullman, Paul probably wrote his letter to the Thessalonians in 50 AD, he had probably disappeared several years prior to the completion of Mark's Gospel. Paul is the most controversial figure in Christianity. He was considered to be a traitor to Jesus's thought by the latter's family, and by the apostles who had stayed in Jerusalem in the circle around James. Paul created Christianity at the expense of those whom Jesus had gathered around him to spread his teachings. He had not known Jesus during his lifetime, and he proved the legitimacy of his mission by declaring that Jesus, raised from the dead, had appeared to him on the road to Damascus. It is quite reasonable to ask what Christianity might have been without Paul, and one could no doubt construct all sorts of hypotheses on this subject. As far as the Gospels are concerned, however, it is almost certain that if this atmosphere of struggle between communities had not existed, we would not have had the writings we possess today. They appeared at a time of fierce struggle between the two communities. These combat writings, as Father Kanengesa calls them, emerged from the multitude of writings on Jesus. These occurred at the time when Paul's style of Christianity won through definitively, and created its own collection of official texts. These texts constituted the canon which condemned and excluded as unorthodox any other documents that were not suited to the line adopted by the Church. The Judeo-Christians have now disappeared as a community with any influence, but one still hears people talking about them under the general term of Judaistic. This is how Cardinal Danielou describes their disappearance. When they were cut off from the great church that gradually freed itself from its Jewish attachments, they petered out very quickly in the West. In the East, however, it is possible to find traces of them in the 3rd and 4th centuries AD, especially in Palestine, Arabia, Transjordania, Syria, and Mesopotamia. Others joined in the orthodoxy of the Great Church, at the same time preserving traces of Semitic culture. Some of these still persist in the churches of Ethiopia and Chaldea. 3. The Four Gospels, Sources and History. In the writings that come from the early stages of Christianity, the Gospels are not mentioned until long after the works of Paul. It was not until the middle of the 2nd century AD, after 140 AD to be precise, that accounts began to appear concerning a collection of evangelic writings. In spite of this, from the beginning of the 2nd century AD, many Christian authors clearly intimate that they knew a great many of Paul's letters. These observations are set out in the introduction to the Ecumenical Translation of the Bible, New Testament edited 19727. They are worth mentioning from the outset, and it is useful to point out here that the work referred to is the result of a collective effort which brought together more than 100 Catholic and Protestant specialists. The Gospels, later to become official, i.e. canonic, did not become known until fairly late, even though they were completed at the beginning of the 2nd century AD according to the Ecumenical Translation. Stories belonging to them began to be quoted around the middle of the 2nd century AD nevertheless. It is nearly always difficult to decide whether the quotations come from written texts that the authors had next to them or if the latter were content to evoke the memory of fragments of the oral tradition. Before 140 AD we read in the commentaries this translation of the Bible contains, there was, in any case, no account by which one might have recognized a collection of evangelic writings. This statement is the opposite of what A. Tricott writes, 1960, in the commentary to his translation of the New Testament, very early on, from the beginning of the 2nd century AD, it became a habit to say gospel, meaning the books that Saint Justin around 150 AD had also called the memoirs of the apostles. Unfortunately, assertions of this kind are sufficiently common for the public to have ideas on the date of the Gospels which are mistaken. The Gospels did not form a complete whole very early on. It did not happen until more than a century after the end of Jesus's mission. The Ecumenical Translation of the Bible estimates the date the four Gospels acquired the status of canonic literature at around 170 AD. Justin's statement, which calls the authors apostles, is not acceptable either, as we shall see. As far as the date the Gospels were written is concerned, A. Tricott states that Matthew's, Mark's and Luke's Gospels were written before 70 AD, but this is not acceptable, except perhaps for Mark. Following many others, this commentator goes out of his way to present the authors of the Gospels as the apostles or the companions of Jesus. For this reason he suggests dates of writing that place them very near to the time Jesus lived. As for John, whom A. Tricott has us believe lived until roughly 100 AD, Christians have always been used to seeing him depicted as being very near to Jesus on ceremonial occasions. It is very difficult, however, to assert that he is the author of the gospel that bears his name. For A. Tricott, as for other commentators, the Apostle John, like Matthew, was the officially qualified witness of the facts he recounts, although the majority of critics do not support the hypothesis which says he wrote the fourth gospel. If, however, the four gospels in question cannot reasonably be regarded as the memoirs of the apostles or companions of Jesus, where do they come from? O. Cullman, in his book The New Testament, Le Nouveau Testament, says of this that the evangelists were only the spokesmen of the early Christian community which wrote down the oral tradition. For 30 or 40 years, the gospel had existed as an almost exclusively oral tradition, the latter only transmitted sayings and isolated narratives. The evangelists strung them together, each in his own way according to his own character and theological preoccupations. They linked up the narrations and sayings handed down by the prevailing tradition. The grouping of Jesus's sayings and likewise the sequence of narratives is made by the use of fairly vague linking phrases such as after this, when he had, etc. In other words, the framework of the Synoptic Gospels is of a purely literary order and is not based on history. The same author continues as follows: it must be noted that the needs of preaching, worship and teaching, more than biographical considerations, were what guided the early community when it wrote down the tradition of the life of Jesus. The apostles illustrated the truth of the faith they were preaching by describing the events in the life of Jesus. Their sermons are what caused the descriptions to be written down. The sayings of Jesus were transmitted, in particular, in the teaching of the Catechism of the early Church. This is exactly how the commentators of the Ecumenical Translation of the Bible describe the writing of the Gospels, the formation of an oral tradition influenced by the preachings of Jesus's disciples and other preachers, the preservation by preaching of this material, which is in actual fact found in the Gospels, by preaching, liturgy, and teaching of the faithful, the slender possibility of a concrete form given by writings to certain confessions of faith, sayings of Jesus, descriptions of the Passion, for example. The fact that the evangelists resort to various written forms as well as data contained in the oral tradition. They resort to these to produce texts which are suitable for various circles, which meet the needs of the Church, explain observations on the Scriptures, correct errors and even, on occasion, answer adversaries' objections. Thus the evangelists, each according to his own outlook, have collected and recorded in writing the material given to them by the oral tradition. This position has been collectively adopted by more than 100 experts in the exegesis of the New Testament, both Catholic and Protestant. It diverges widely from the line established by the Second Vatican Council in its dogmatic constitution on the revelation drawn up between 1962 and 1965. This conciliar document has already been referred to once above, when talking of the Old Testament. The Council was able to declare of the latter that the books which compose it contain material which is imperfect and obsolete, but it has not expressed the same reservations about the Gospels. On the contrary, as we read in the following, nobody can overlook the fact that, among all the Scriptures, even those of the New Testament, the Gospels have a well-deserved position of superiority. This is by virtue of the fact that they represent the most preeminent witness to the life and teachings of the incarnate Word, our Saviour. At all times and in all places the Church has maintained and still maintains the apostolic origin of the four Gospels. What the Apostles actually preached on Christ's orders, both they and the men in their following subsequently transmitted, with the divine inspiration of the Spirit, in writings which are the foundation of the faith, that is, the fourfold gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Our Holy Mother, the Church, has firmly maintained and still maintains with the greatest constancy, that these four gospels, which it unhesitatingly confirms are historically authentic, faithfully transmit what Jesus, Son of God, actually did and taught during his life among men for their eternal salvation until the day when he was taken up into the heavens. The sacred authors therefore composed the four Gospels in such a way as to always give us true and frank information on the life of Jesus. This is an unambiguous affirmation of the fidelity with which the Gospels transmit the acts and sayings of Jesus. There is hardly any compatibility between the Council's affirmation and what the authors quoted above claim. In particular, the following: the Gospels are not to be taken literally, they are writings suited to an occasion or combat writings. Their authors are writing down the traditions of their own community concerning Jesus. Father Canon Gesser. The Gospels are texts which are suitable for various circles, meet the needs of the Church, explain observations on the Scriptures, correct errors and even, on occasion, answer adversaries' objections. Thus, the evangelists, each according to his own outlook, have collected and recorded in writing the material given to them by the oral tradition. Ecumenical translation of the Bible. It is quite clear that we are here faced with contradictory statements, the declaration of the Council on the one hand, and more recently adopted attitudes on the other. According to the declaration of the Second Vatican Council, a faithful account of the actions and words of Jesus is to be found in the Gospels, but it is impossible to reconcile this with the existence in the text of contradictions, improbabilities, things which are materially impossible or statements which run contrary to firmly established reality. If, on the other hand, one chooses to regard the Gospels as expressing the personal point of view of those who collected the oral traditions that belonged to various communities, or as writings suited to an occasion or combat writings, it does not come as a surprise to find faults in the Gospels. All these faults are the sign that they were written by men in circumstances such as these. The writers may have been quite sincere, even though they relate facts without doubting their inaccuracy. They provide us with descriptions which contradict other authors' narrations, or are influenced by reasons of religious rivalry between communities. They therefore present stories about the life of Jesus from a completely different angle than their adversaries. It has already been shown how the historical context is in harmony with the second approach to the Gospels. The data we have on the texts themselves definitively confirms it. The Gospel according to Matthew. Matthew's is the first of the four Gospels as they appear in the New Testament. This position is perfectly justified by the fact that it is a prolongation, as it were, of the Old Testament. It was written to show that Jesus fulfilled the history of Israel, as the commentators of the ecumenical translation of the Bible note, and on which we shall be drawing heavily. For this reason, Matthew constantly refers to quotations from the Old Testament, showing that Jesus acted as if he were the Messiah the Jews were awaiting. This gospel begins with a genealogy of Jesus. Matthew traces it back to Abraham via David. We shall presently see the fault in the text that most commentators silently ignore. Matthew's obvious intention was nevertheless to indicate the general tenor of his work straight away by establishing this line of descendants. The author continues the same line of thought by constantly bringing to the forefront Jesus's attitude toward Jewish law, the main principles of which, praying, fasting, and dispensing charity, are summarized here. Jesus addresses his teachings first and foremost to his own people. This is how he speaks to the 12 apostles: "Go nowhere among the Gentiles, and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Matthew 10:5-6. "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Matthew 15:24. At the end of his gospel, in second place, Matthew extends the apostolic mission of Jesus's first disciples to all nations. He makes Jesus give the following order: "Go therefore and make disciples of all nations," Matthew 28:19, but the primary destination must be the house of Israel. A. Tricot says of this gospel, "Beneath its Greek garb, the flesh and bones of this book are Jewish, and so is its spirit. It has a Jewish feel and bears its distinctive signs." On the basis of these observations alone, the origins of Matthew's gospel may be placed in the tradition of a Judeo-Christian community. According to O. Cullman, this community was trying to break away from Judaism while at the same time preserving the continuity of the Old Testament. The main preoccupations and the general tenor of this gospel point towards a strained situation. There are also political factors to be found in the text. The Roman occupation of Palestine naturally heightened the desire of this country to see itself liberated. They prayed for God to intervene in favor of the people he had chosen among all others, and as their omnipotent sovereign who could give direct support to the affairs of men, as he had already done many times in the course of history. What sort of person was Matthew? Let us say straight away that he is no longer acknowledged to be one of Jesus's companions. A. Tricot nevertheless presents him as such in his commentary to the translation of the New Testament, 1960. Matthew, alias Levi, was a customs officer employed at the tollgate or customs house at Capernaum when Jesus called him to be one of his disciples. This is the opinion of the fathers of the church: Origen, Jerome, and Epiphanes. This opinion is no longer held today. One point which is uncontested is that the author is writing for people who speak Greek, but nevertheless know Jewish customs and the Aramaic language. It would seem that for the commentators of the ecumenical translation, the origins of this gospel are as follows: it is normally considered to have been written in Syria, perhaps at Antioch, or in Phoenicia, because a great many Jews lived in these countries. We have indications of a polemic against the Orthodox Judaism of the synagogue and the Pharisees, such as was manifested at the synagogal assembly at Jamina circa 80 AD. In such conditions, there are many authors who date the first of the Gospels at about 80 to 90 AD, perhaps also a little earlier. It is not possible to be absolutely definite about this. Since we do not know the author's exact name, we must be satisfied with a few outlines traced in the gospel itself. The author can be recognized by his profession. He is well versed in Jewish writings and traditions. He knows, respects, but vigorously challenges the religious leaders of his people. He is a past master in the art of teaching and making Jesus understandable to his listeners. He always insists on the practical consequences of his teachings. He would fit fairly well the description of an educated Jew turned Christian, a householder who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old, as Matthew says, 13:52. This is a long way from the civil servant at Capernaum, whom Mark and Luke call Levi, and who had become one of the 12 apostles. Everyone agrees in thinking that Matthew wrote his gospel using the same sources as Mark and Luke. His narration is, as we shall see, different on several essential points. In spite of this, Matthew borrowed heavily from Mark's gospel, although the latter was not one of Jesus's disciples, O. Cullman. Matthew takes very serious liberties with the text. We shall see this when we discuss the Old Testament in relation to the genealogy of Jesus, which is placed at the beginning of his gospel. He inserts into his book descriptions which are quite literally incredible. This is the adjective used in the work mentioned above by Father Canangiesa, referring to an episode in the resurrection, the episode of the guard. He points out the improbability of the story, referring to military guards at the tomb, these Gentile soldiers who report, not to their hierarchical superiors, but to the high priests who pay them to tell lies. He adds, however, one must not laugh at him, because Matthew's intention was extremely serious. In his own way, he incorporates ancient data from the oral tradition into his written work. The scenario is nevertheless worthy of Jesus Christ Superstar. Let us not forget that this opinion on Matthew comes from an eminent theologian teaching at the Catholic Institute of Paris, Institut Catholique de Paris. Matthew relates in his narration the events accompanying the death of Jesus. They are another example of his imagination. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two, from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split, the tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of tombs after his resurrection they went into the holy city and appeared to many. This passage from Matthew 27:51-53 has no corresponding passage in the other Gospels. It is difficult to see how the bodies of the saints in question could have raised from the dead at the time of Jesus's death. According to the Gospels, it was on the eve of the Sabbath, and only emerged from their tombs after his resurrection, according to the same sources, on the day after the Sabbath. The most notable improbability is perhaps to be found in Matthew. It is the most difficult to rationalize of all that the Gospel authors claim Jesus said. He relates in chapter 12, 38-40, the episode concerning Jonah's sign. Jesus was among the scribes and Pharisees who addressed him in the following terms: "Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you." But he answered them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth." Jesus therefore proclaims that he will stay in the earth 3 days and 3 nights. So Matthew, along with Luke and Mark, place the death and burial of Jesus on the eve of the Sabbath. This, of course, makes the time spent in the earth 3 days, but this period can only include 2 and not 3 nights. Gospel commentators frequently ignore this episode. Father Regay nevertheless points out this improbability when he notes that Jesus only stayed in the tomb 3 days, one of them complete, and 2 nights. He adds, however, that it is a set expression and really means 3 days. It is disturbing to see commentators reduced to using arguments that do not contain any positive meaning. It would be much more satisfying intellectually to say that a gross error such as this was the result of a scribe's mistake. Apart from these improbabilities, what mostly distinguishes Matthew's gospel is that it is the work of a Judeo-Christian community in the process of breaking away from Judaism while remaining in line with the Old Testament. From the point of view of Judeo-Christian history, it is very important. The Gospel according to Mark. This is the shortest of the four Gospels. It is also the oldest, but in spite of this it is not a book written by an apostle. At best it was written by an apostle's disciple. O. Cullman has written that he does not consider Mark to be a disciple of Jesus. The author nevertheless points out, to those who have misgivings about the ascription of this Gospel to the apostle Mark, that Matthew and Luke would not have used this gospel in the way they did had they not known that it was indeed based on the teachings of an apostle. This argument is in no way decisive. O'Coleman backs up the reservations he expresses by saying that he frequently quotes from the New Testament the sayings of a certain John nicknamed Mark. These quotations do not, however, mention the name of a gospel author, and the text of Mark itself does not name any author. The paucity of information on this point has led commentators to dwell on details that seem rather extravagant, using the pretext, for example, that Mark was the only evangelist to relate in his description of the Passion the story of the young man who had nothing but a linen cloth about his body and, when seized, left the linen cloth and ran away naked, Mark 14:51-52. They conclude that the young man must have been Mark, the faithful disciple who tried to follow the teacher, Ecumenical Translation. Other commentators see in this personal memory a sign of authenticity, an anonymous signature, which proves that he was an eyewitness, O'Coleman. O'Coleman considers that many turns of phrase corroborate the hypothesis that the author was of Jewish origin, but the presence of Latin expressions might suggest that he had written his gospel in Rome. He addresses himself moreover to Christians not living in Palestine and is careful to explain the Aramaic expressions he uses. Tradition has indeed tended to see Mark as Peter's companion in Rome. It is founded on the final section of Peter's first letter, always supposing that he was indeed the author. Peter wrote in his letter, "The community which is at Babylon, which is likewise chosen, sends you greetings, and so does my son Mark." By Babylon, what is probably meant is Rome, we read in the commentary to the Ecumenical Translation. From this, the commentators then imagine themselves authorized to conclude that Mark, who was supposed to have been with Peter in Rome, was the evangelist. One wonders whether it was not the same line of reasoning that led Poppius, bishop of Hierapolis in circa 150 AD, to ascribe this gospel to Mark as Peter's interpreter and the possible collaborator of Paul. Seen from this point of view, the composition of Mark's gospel could be placed after Peter's death, that is, at between 65 and 70 AD for the Ecumenical Translation and circa 70 AD for O'Coleman. The text itself unquestionably reveals a major flaw. It is written with a total disregard to chronology. Mark therefore places, at the beginning of his narration, 1:16-20, the episode of the four fishermen whom Jesus leads to follow him by simply saying, "I will make you become fishers of men," though they do not even know him. The evangelist shows, among other things, a complete lack of plausibility. As Father Rigay has said, Mark is a clumsy writer, the weakest of all the evangelists. He hardly knows how to write a narrative. The commentator reinforces his observation by quoting a passage about how the 12 apostles were selected. Here is the literal translation. "And he went up into the hills, and called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he made that the 12 were to be with him, and to be sent out to preach and have authority to cast out demons, and he made the 12 and imposed the name Simon on Peter," Mark 3:13-16. He contradicts Matthew and Luke, as has already been noted above, with regard to the sign of Jonah. On the subject of signs given by Jesus to men in the course of his mission, Mark 8:11-13, describes an episode that is hardly credible. "The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven, to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit, and said, 'Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation.' And he left them, and getting into the boat again he departed to the other side." There can be no doubt that this is an affirmation coming from Jesus himself about his intention not to commit any act which might appear supernatural. Therefore, the commentators of the Ecumenical Translation, who are surprised that Luke says Jesus will only give one sign, the sign of Jonah, see Matthew's Gospel, consider it paradoxical that Mark should say no sign shall be given to this generation seeing, as they note, the miracles that Jesus himself gives as a sign, Luke 7:22 and 11:20. Mark's Gospel as a whole is officially recognized as being canonic. All the same, the final section of Mark's Gospel, 16:19-20, is considered by modern authors to have been tacked on to the basic work. The ecumenical translation is quite explicit about this. This final section is not contained in the two oldest complete manuscripts of the Gospels, the Codex Vaticanus and the Codex Sinaiticus, that date from the 4th century AD. Kuhlmann notes on this subject that more recent Greek manuscripts and certain versions at this point added a conclusion on appearances which is not drawn from Mark but from the other Gospels. In fact, the versions of this added ending are very numerous. In the texts there are long and short versions, both are reproduced in the Bible, Revised Standard Version, 1952. Sometimes the long version has some additional material. Father Canningesser makes the following comments on the ending. The last verses must have been suppressed when his work was officially received, or the popular version of it, in the community that guaranteed its validity. Neither Matthew, Luke nor a fortiori John saw the missing section. Nevertheless, the gap was unacceptable. A long time afterwards, when the writings of Matthew, Luke, and John, all of them similar, had been in circulation, a worthy ending to Mark was composed. Its elements were taken from sources throughout the other Gospels. It would be easy to recognize the pieces of the puzzle by enumerating Mark 16:9-20. One would gain a more concrete idea of the free way in which the literary genre of the evangelic narration was handled until the beginnings of the 2nd century AD. What a blunt admission is provided for us here, in the thoughts of a great theologian, that human manipulation exists in the texts of the scriptures. The Gospel according to Luke. For O. Kuhlmann, Luke is a chronicler, and for Father Canningesser he is a true novelist. In his prologue to Theophilus, Luke warns us that he, in his turn, following on from others who have written accounts concerning Jesus, is going to write a narrative of the same facts using the accounts and information of eyewitnesses, implying that he himself is not one, including information from the apostles' preaching. It is therefore to be a methodical piece of work which he introduces in the following terms. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having informed myself about all things from their beginnings, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the truth concerning things of which you have been informed. From the very first line one can see all that separates Luke from the scribbler Mark, to whose work we have just referred. Luke's Gospel is incontestably a literary work written in classical Greek, free from any barbarisms. Luke was a cultivated Gentile convert to Christianity. His attitude towards the Jews is immediately apparent. As O. Kuhlmann points out, Luke leaves out Mark's most Judaic verses and highlights the Jews' incredulity at Jesus's words, throwing into relief his good relations with the Samaritans, whom the Jews detested. Matthew, on the other hand, as Jesus asked the apostles to flee from them. This is just one of many striking examples of the fact that the evangelists make Jesus say whatever suits their own personal outlook. They probably do so with sincere conviction. They give us the version of Jesus's words that is adapted to the point of view of their own community. How can one deny, in the face of such evidence, that the Gospels are combat writings or writings suited to an occasion, as has been mentioned already? The comparison between the general tone of Luke's Gospel and Matthew's is in this respect a good demonstration. Who was Luke? An attempt has been made to identify him with the physician of the same name referred to by Paul in several of his letters. The ecumenical translation notes that several commentators have found the medical occupation of the author of this Gospel confirmed by the precision with which he describes the sick. This assessment is in fact exaggerated out of all proportion. Luke does not, properly speaking, describe things of this kind. The vocabulary he uses is that of a cultivated man of his time. There was a Luke who was Paul's traveling companion, but was he the same person? O. Kuhlmann thinks he was. The date of Luke's Gospel can be estimated according to several factors. Luke used Mark's and Matthew's Gospels. From what we read in the ecumenical translation, it seems that he witnessed the siege and destruction of Jerusalem by Titus's armies in 70 AD. The Gospel probably dates from after this time. Present-day critics situate the time it was written at circa 80 to 90 AD, but several place it at an even earlier date. The various narrations in Luke show important differences when compared to his predecessors. An outline of this has already been given. The ecumenical translation indicates them on pages 181 et second. O. Cullman, in his book, The New Testament, Le Nouveau Testament, page 18, cites descriptions in Luke's Gospel that are not to be found anywhere else. And they are not about minor points of detail. The descriptions of Jesus's childhood are unique to Luke's Gospel. Matthew describes Jesus's childhood differently from Luke, and Mark does not mention it at all. Matthew and Luke both provide different genealogies of Jesus. The contradictions are so large and the improbabilities so great, from a scientific point of view, that a special chapter of this book has been devoted to the subject. It is possible to explain why Matthew, who was addressing himself to Jews, should begin the genealogy at Abraham, and include David in it, and that Luke, as a converted Gentile, should want to go back even farther. We shall see, however, that the two genealogies contradict each other from David onwards. Jesus's mission is described differently on many points by Luke, Matthew, and Mark. An event of such great importance to Christians as the institution of the Eucharist gives rise to variations between Luke and the other two evangelists. Father Riguet notes in his book Initiation to the Gospel, page 75, that the words used to institute the Eucharist are reported by Luke 22, 19-24, in a form very different from the wording in Matthew 26, 26-29, and in Mark 14, 22-24, which is almost identical. On the contrary, he writes, the wording transmitted by Luke is very similar to that evoked by St. Paul, 1st letter to the Corinthians, 11, 23-25. As we have seen, in his Gospel, Luke expresses ideas on the subject of Jesus's ascension which contradict what he says in the Acts of the Apostles. He is recognized as their author and they form an integral part of the New Testament. In his Gospel he situates the ascension on Easter Day, and in the Acts 40 days later. We already know to what strange commentaries this contradiction has led Christian experts in exegesis. Commentators wishing to be objective, such as those of the Ecumenical Translation of the Bible, have been obliged to recognize as a general rule the fact that for Luke the main preoccupation was not to write facts corresponding to material accuracy. When Father Canningesa compares the descriptions in the Acts of the Apostles written by Luke himself with the description of similar facts on Jesus raised from the dead by Paul, he pronounces the following opinion on Luke. Luke is the most sensitive and literary of the four evangelists. He has all the qualities of a true novelist. The Gospel according to John. John's Gospel is radically different from the three others, to such an extent indeed that Father Riguet in his book Initiation to the Gospel, having commented on the other three, immediately evokes a startling image for the fourth. He calls it, Different World. It is indeed a unique book, different in the arrangement and choice of subject, description and speech, different in its style, geography, chronology. There are even differences in theological outlook, O. Cullman. Jesus's words are therefore differently recorded by John from the other evangelists. Father Riguet notes on this that whereas the synoptics record Jesus's words in a style that is striking, much nearer to the oral style, in John all is meditation, to such an extent indeed that one sometimes wonders if Jesus is still speaking or whether his ideas have not imperceptibly been extended by the evangelist's own thoughts. Who was the author? This is a highly debated question and extremely varying opinions have been expressed on this subject. Tricot and Father Riguet belong to a camp that does not have the slightest misgivings. John's Gospel is the work of an eyewitness, its author is John, son of Zebedee and brother of James. Many details are known about this apostle and are set out in works for mass publication. Popular iconography puts him near Jesus, as in the Last Supper prior to the Passion. Who could imagine that John's Gospel was not the work of John the Apostle, whose figure is so familiar? The fact that the fourth Gospel was written so late is not a serious argument against this opinion. The definitive version was probably written around the end of the 1st century AD to situate the time it was written at 60 years after Jesus would be in keeping with an apostle, who was very young at the time of Jesus and who lived to be almost 100. Father Kenningesa, in his study on the resurrection, arrives at the conclusion that none of the New Testament authors, save Paul, can claim to have been eyewitnesses to Jesus's resurrection. John nevertheless related the appearance to a number of the assembled apostles, of which he was probably a member, in the absence of Thomas, 20:19-24, then 8 days later to the full group of apostles, 20:25-29. O'Culman in his work The New Testament does not subscribe to this view. The Ecumenical Translation of the Bible states that the majority of critics do not accept the hypothesis that the Gospel was written by John, although this possibility cannot be entirely ruled out. Everything points, however, towards the fact that the text we know today had several authors. It is probable that the Gospel as it stands today was put into circulation by the author's disciples, who added chapter 21, and very likely several annotations. With regard to the story of the adulterous woman, 7:53-8:11, everyone agrees that it is a fragment of unknown origin inserted later, but nevertheless belonging to canonic scripture. Passage 19:35 appears as a signature of an eyewitness, O'Culman, the only explicit signature in the whole of John's Gospel, but commentators believe that it was probably added later. Culman thinks that latter additions are obvious in this Gospel, such as chapter 21, which is probably the work of a disciple who may well have made slight alterations to the main body of the Gospel. It is not necessary to mention all the hypotheses suggested by experts in exegesis. The remarks recorded here made by the most eminent Christian writers on the questions of the authorship of the fourth Gospel are sufficient to show the extent of the confusion reigning on the subject of its authorship. The historical value of John's stories has been contested to a great extent. The discrepancy between them and the other three Gospels is quite blatant. O'Culman offers an explanation for this. He sees in John a different theological point of view from the other evangelists. This aim directs the choice of stories from the lawyer recorded, as well as the way in which they are reproduced. Thus, the author often prolongs the lines and makes the historical Jesus say what the Holy Spirit itself revealed to him. This, for the exegete in question, is the reason for the discrepancies. It is of course quite conceivable that John, who was writing after the other evangelists, should have chosen certain stories suitable for illustrating his own theories. One should not be surprised by the fact that certain descriptions contained in the other Gospels are missing in John. The Ecumenical Translation picks out a certain number of such instances, page 282. Certain gaps hardly seem credible, however, like the fact that the institution of the Eucharist is not described. It is unthinkable that an episode so basic to Christianity, one indeed that was to be the mainstay of its liturgy, that is, the Mass, should not be mentioned by John, the most preeminently meditative evangelist. The fact is, he limits himself, in the narrative of the supper prior to the Passion, to simply describing the washing of the disciples' feet, the prediction of Judas's betrayal and Peter's denial. In contrast to this, there are stories which are unique to John and not present in the other three. The Ecumenical Translation mentions these, page 283. Here again, one could infer that the three authors did not see the importance in these episodes that John saw in them. It is difficult, however, not to be taken aback when one finds in John a description of the appearance of Jesus raised from the dead to his disciples beside the Sea of Tiberias, John 21:1-14. The description is nothing less than the reproduction, with numerous added details, of the miracle catch of fish which Luke 5:1-11, presents as an episode that occurred during Jesus's life. In his description, Luke alludes to the presence of the Apostle John, who, as tradition has it, was the evangelist, since this description in John's Gospel forms part of chapter 21, agreed to be a later addition, one can easily imagine that the reference to John's name in Luke could have led to its artificial inclusion in the fourth gospel. The necessity of transforming a description from Jesus's life to a posthumous description in no way prevented the evangelical text from being manipulated. Another important point on which John's gospel differs from the other three is in the duration of Jesus's mission. Mark, Matthew, and Luke place it over a period of 1 year. John spreads it over 2 years. O. Cullman notes this fact. On this subject, the ecumenical translation expresses the following. The synoptics describe a long period in Galilee followed by a march that was more or less prolonged towards Judea, and finally a brief stay in Jerusalem. John, on the other hand, describes frequent journeys from one area to another and mentions a long stay in Judea, especially in Jerusalem, 1:19-51, 2:13-3, 36:5, 1-47, 14:20-31. He mentions several Passover celebrations, 2:13, 5:1, 6:4, 11:55, and thus suggests a ministry that lasted more than 2 years. Which one of them should one believe, Mark, Matthew, Luke or John? Sources of the Gospels. The general outline that has been given here of the Gospels and which emerges from a critical examination of the texts tends to make one think of a literature which is disjointed, with a plan that lacks continuity and seemingly insuperable contradictions. These are the terms used in the judgment passed on them by the commentators of the ecumenical translation of the Bible. It is important to refer to their authority because the consequences of an appraisal of this subject are extremely serious. It has already been seen how a few notions concerning the religious history of the time when the Gospels were written helped to explain certain disconcerting aspects of this literature apparent to the thoughtful reader. It is necessary to continue, however, and ascertain what present-day works can tell us about the sources the evangelists drew on when writing their texts. It is also interesting to see whether the history of the texts once they were established can help to explain certain aspects they present today. The problem of sources was approached in a very simplistic fashion at the time of the fathers of the Church. In the early centuries of Christianity, the only source available was the Gospel that the complete manuscripts provided first, that is, Matthew's Gospel. The problem of sources only concerned Mark and Luke because John constituted a quite separate case. Saint Augustine held that Mark, who appears second in the traditional order of presentation, had been inspired by Matthew and had summarized his work. He further considered that Luke, who comes third in the manuscripts, had used data from both. His prologue suggests this, and has already been discussed. The experts in exegesis at this period were as able as we are to estimate the degree of corroboration between the texts and find a large number of verses common to two or three synoptics. Today, the commentators of the ecumenical translation of the Bible provide the following figures. Verses common to all three synoptics 330. Verses common to Mark and Matthew 178. Verses common to Mark and Luke 100. Verses common to Matthew and Luke 230. The verses unique to each of the first three Gospels are as follows, Matthew 330, Mark 53, and Luke 500. From the fathers of the Church until the end of the 18th century AD, 1.5 millennia passed without any new problems being raised on the sources of the evangelists, people continued to follow tradition. It was not until modern times that it was realized, on the basis of these data, how each evangelist had taken material found in the others and compiled his own specific narration guided by his own personal views. Great weight was attached to actual collection of material for the narration. It came from the oral traditions of the communities from which it originated on the one hand, and from a common written Aramaic source that has not been rediscovered on the other. This written source could have formed a compact mass or have been composed of many fragments of different narrations used by each evangelist to construct his own original work. More intensive studies in circa the last 100 years have led to theories which are more detailed and in time will become even more complicated. The first of the modem theories is the so-called Holtzman Two Sources Theory, 1863. O. Cullman and the Ecumenical Translation explain that, according to this theory, Matthew and Luke may have been inspired by Mark on the one hand, and on the other by a common document which has since been lost. The first two, moreover, each had his own sources. Cullman criticizes the above on the following points. Mark's work, used by both Luke and Matthew, was probably not the author's gospel but an earlier version. The diagram does not lay enough emphasis on the oral tradition. This appears to be of paramount importance because it alone preserved Jesus' words and the descriptions of his mission during a period of 30 or 40 years, as each of the evangelists was only the spokesman for the Christian community which wrote down the oral tradition. This is how it is possible to conclude that the Gospels we possess today are a reflection of what the early Christian communities knew of Jesus's life and ministry. They also mirror their beliefs and theological ideas, of which the evangelists were the spokesman. The latest studies in textual criticism on the sources of the Gospels have clearly shown an even more complicated formation process of the texts. A book by Fathers Benoit and Boismard, both professors at the Biblical School of Jerusalem, 1972-1973, called The Synopsis of the Four Gospels, stresses the evolution of the text in stages parallel to the evolution of the tradition. This implies the consequences set out by Father Benoit in his introduction to Father Boismard's part of the work. He presents them in the following terms. The wording and form of description that result from a long evolution of tradition are not as authentic as in the original. Some readers of this work will perhaps be surprised or embarrassed to learn that certain of Jesus' sayings, parables, or predictions of his destiny were not expressed in the way we read them today, but were altered and adapted by those who transmitted them to us. This may come as a source of amazement and even scandal to those not used to this kind of historical investigation. The alterations and adaptations to the texts made by those transmitting them to us were done in a way that Father Boismard explains by means of a highly complex diagram. It is a development of the so-called two sources theory, and is the product of examination and comparison of the texts which it is not possible to summarize here. Those readers who are interested in obtaining further details should consult the original work published by Les Editions du Cerf, Paris. Four basic documents, A, B, C and Q, represent the original sources of the Gospels, see General Diagram. Page 76. Documenta comes from a Judeo-Christian source. Matthew and Mark were inspired by it. Document B is a reinterpretation of Document A, for use in pagan Christian churches. All the evangelists were inspired by it except Matthew. Document C inspired Mark, Luke, and John. Document Q constitutes the majority of sources common to Matthew and Luke. It is the common document in the two sources theory referred to earlier. None of these basic documents led to the production of the definitive texts we know today. Between them and the final version lay the intermediate versions, intermediate Matthew, intermediate Mark, intermediate Luke, and intermediate John. These four intermediate documents were to lead to the final versions of the four Gospels, as well as to inspire the final corresponding versions of other Gospels. One only has to consult the diagram to see the intricate relationships the author has revealed. The results of this scriptural research are of great importance. They show how the Gospel texts not only have a history, to be discussed later, but also a prehistory, to use Father Boismard's expression. What is meant is that before the final versions appeared, they underwent alterations at the intermediate document stage. Thus it is possible to explain, for example, how a well-known story from Jesus's life, such as the miracle catch of Cana, is shown in Luke to be an event that happened during his life, and in John to be one of his appearances after his resurrection. The conclusion to be drawn from the above is that when we read the Gospel, we can no longer be at all sure that we are reading Jesus's word. Father Benoit addresses himself to the readers of the Gospel by warning them and giving them the following compensation: if the reader is obliged in more than one case to give up the notion of hearing Jesus's voice directly, he still hears the voice of the church and he relies upon it as the divinely appointed interpreter of the Master who long ago spoke to us on earth and who now speaks to us in his glory. How to reconcile this formal finding of the inauthenticity of certain texts with the sentence of the dogmatic constitution on the divine revelation of the Council of Vatican II, which assures us on the contrary of a faithful transmission of the words of Jesus, these are Gospels, which it, the Church, unhesitatingly confirms are historically authentic, faithfully transmit what Jesus, Son of God, actually did and taught during his life among men for their eternal salvation, until the day when he was taken up into the heavens. It is quite clear that the work of the Biblical School of Jerusalem flatly contradicts the Council's declaration. M.E. Boismard, Synopsis of the Four Gospels, General Diagram Documents A, B, C, Q equals Basic Documents used in the compiling of the texts. Intermediate equals Intermediate version of the text. History of the texts. One would be mistaken in thinking that once the Gospels were written they constituted the basic scriptures of the newly born Christianity, and that people referred to them the same way they referred to the Old Testament. At that time, the foremost authority was the oral tradition as a vehicle for Jesus's words and the teachings of the apostles. The first writings to circulate were Paul's letters, and they occupied a prevalent position long before the Gospels. They were, after all, written several decades earlier. It has already been shown that contrary to what certain commentators are still writing today, before 140 AD there was no witness to the knowledge that a collection of gospel writings existed. It was not until circa 170 AD that the four gospels acquired the status of canonic literature. In the early days of Christianity, many writings on Jesus were in circulation. They were not subsequently retained as being worthy of authenticity and the Church ordered them to be hidden, hence their name Apocrypha. Some of the texts of these works have been well preserved because they benefited from the fact that they were generally valued, to quote the ecumenical translation. The same was true for the letter of Barnabas, but unfortunately others were more brutally thrust aside and only fragments of them remain. They were considered to be the messengers of error and were removed from the sight of the faithful. Works such as the Gospels of the Nazarenes, the Gospels of the Hebrews and the Gospels of the Egyptians, known through quotations taken from the Fathers of the Church, were nevertheless fairly closely related to the canonic Gospels. The same holds good for Thomas's Gospel and Barnabas's Gospel. Some of these apocryphal writings contain imaginary details, the product of popular fantasy. Authors of works on the Apocrypha also quote with obvious satisfaction passages which are literally ridiculous. Passages such as these are, however, to be found in all the Gospels. One has only to think of the imaginary description of events that Matthew claims took place at Jesus's death. It is possible to find passages lacking seriousness in all the early writings of Christianity, one must be honest enough to admit this. The abundance of literature concerning Jesus led the Church to make certain excisions while the latter was in the process of becoming organized. Perhaps 100 Gospels were suppressed. Only 4 were retained and put on the official list of Neo Testament writings making up what is called the canon. In the middle of the 2nd century AD, Marcion of Sinope put heavy pressure on the ecclesiastic authorities to take a stand on this. He was an ardent enemy of the Jews and at that time rejected the whole of the Old Testament and everything in writings produced after Jesus that seemed to him too close to the Old Testament or to come from the Judeo-Christian tradition. Marcion only acknowledged the value of Luke's Gospel because he believed Luke to be the spokesman of Paul and his writings. The Church declared Marcion a heretic and put into its canon all the letters of Paul, but included the other Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They also added several other works such as the Acts of the Apostles. The official list nevertheless varies with time during the first centuries of Christianity. For a while, works that were later considered not to be valid, i.e. Apocrypha, figured in it, while other works contained in today's New Testament canon were excluded from it at this time. These hesitations lasted until the councils of Hippo Regius in 393 and Carthage in 397. The four Gospels always figured in it, however. One may join Father Boismard in regretting the disappearance of a vast quantity of literature declared apocryphal by the Church, although it was of historical interest. The above author indeed gives it a place in his synopsis of the four Gospels alongside that of the official Gospels. He notes that these books still existed in libraries near the end of the 4th century AD. This was the century that saw things put into serious order. The oldest manuscripts of the Gospels date from this period. Documents prior to this, i.e. papyri from the 3rd century AD and one possibly dating from the 2nd, only transmit fragments to us. The two oldest parchment manuscripts are Greek, 4th century AD. They are the Codex Vaticanus, preserved in the Vatican Library, and whose place of discovery is unknown, and the Codex Sinaiticus, which was discovered on Mount Sinai and is now preserved in the British Museum, London. The second contains two apocryphal works. According to the Ecumenical Translation, 250 other known parchments exist throughout the world, the last of these being from the 11th century AD. Not all the copies of the New Testament that have come down to us are identical, however. On the contrary, it is possible to distinguish differences of varying degrees of importance between them, but however important they may be, there is always a large number of them. Some of these only concern differences of grammatical detail, vocabulary or word order. Elsewhere, however, differences between manuscripts can be seen which affect the meaning of whole passages. If one wishes to see the extent of textual differences, one only has to glance through the Novum Testamentum Graeus. This work contains a so-called middle-of-the-road Greek text. It is a text of synthesis with notes containing all the variations found in the different versions. The authenticity of a text, and of even the most venerable manuscript, is always open to debate. The Codex Vaticanus is a good example of this. The facsimile reproductions edited by the Vatican City, 1965, contains an accompanying note from its editors informing us that several centuries after it was copied, believed to have been in circa the 10th or 11th century, ascribing to over all the letters except those he thought were a mistake. There are passages in the text where the original letters in light brown still show through, contrasting visibly with the rest of the text which is in dark brown. There is no indication that it was a faithful restoration. The note states moreover that the different hands that corrected and annotated the manuscript over the centuries have not yet been definitively discerned. A certain number of corrections were undoubtedly made when the text was inked over. In all the religious manuals, the text is presented as a 4th century copy. One has to go to sources at the Vatican to discover that various hands may have altered the text centuries later. One might reply that other texts may be used for comparison, but how does one choose between variations that change the meaning? It is a well-known fact that a very old scribe's correction can lead to the definitive reproduction of the corrected text. We shall see further on how a single word in a passage from John concerning the Paraclete radically alters its meaning and completely changes its sense when viewed from a theological point of view. O. Cullman, in his book, The New Testament, writes the following on the subject of variations. Sometimes the latter are the result of inadvertent flaws. The copier misses a word out, or conversely writes it twice, or a whole section of a sentence is carelessly omitted because in the manuscript to be copied it appeared between two identical words. Sometimes it is a matter of deliberate corrections. Either the copier has taken the liberty of correcting the text according to his own ideas, or he has tried to bring it into line with a parallel text in a more or less skillful attempt to reduce the number of discrepancies. As, little by little, the New Testament writings broke away from the rest of early Christian literature, and came to be regarded as Holy Scripture, so the copiers became more and more hesitant about taking the same liberties as their predecessors. They thought they were copying the authentic text, but in fact wrote down the variations. Finally, a copier sometimes wrote annotations in the margin to explain an obscure passage. The following copier, thinking that the sentence he found in the margin had been left out of the passage by his predecessor, thought it necessary to include the margin notes in the text. This process often made the new text even more obscure. The scribes of some manuscripts sometimes took exceedingly great liberties with the texts. This is the case of one of the most venerable manuscripts after the two referred to above, the 6th century Codex Besicantabrigensis. The scribe probably noticed the difference between Luke's and Matthew's genealogy of Jesus, so he put Matthew's genealogy into his copy of Luke, but as the second contained fewer names than the first, he padded it out with extra names, without balancing them up. Is it possible to say that the Latin translations, such as St. Jerome's 6th century Vulgate, or older translations, Vetus Italia, or Syriac and Coptic translations are any more faithful than the basic Greek manuscripts? They might have been made from manuscripts older than the ones referred to above and subsequently lost to the present day. We just do not know. It has been possible to group the bulk of these versions into families all bearing a certain number of common traits. According to O. Cullman, one can define a so-called Syrian text, whose constitution could have led to the majority of the oldest Greek manuscripts. This text was widely disseminated throughout Europe from the 16th century AD onwards thanks to printing. The specialists say that it is probably the worst text. A so-called Western text, with Old Latin versions and the Codex Besicantabrigensis, which is in both Greek and Latin, according to the Ecumenical Translation, one of its characteristics is a definite tendency to provide explanations, paraphrases, inaccurate data, and harmonizations. The so-called neutral text, containing the Codex Vaticanus and the Codex Sinaiticus, is said to have a fairly high level of purity. Modern editions of the New Testament readily follow it, although it too has its flaws, Ecumenical Translation. All that modern textual criticism can do in this respect is to try and reconstitute a text which has the most likelihood of coming near to the original. In any case, there can be no hope of going back to the original text itself. Ecumenical Translation.